Ken, thank you so much. I got to say, I'm a hard act to follow. I'll do my best. Congratulations to all the Weaver Fellows who are here and the new inductees to that program, and to my good friend Dr. Ed and his induction to the ranks of it's distinguished, not extinguished, right? Is that okay? And I've greatly enjoyed this program, learned a lot from it, and I must say that given the Weaver part and the digital part, I felt like focusing on the Weaver part. I am a low-tech person without computer skills. And Ken had someone from his office call me about 2 weeks ago to get my email address. I said, I don't have an email address. However, I do have something called assisted email for the elderly. And this is an earmark that I got Trent Lott put into an appropriations bill. Nobody read the bill, of course, so it went right through. So I now have a federally funded email assistant to handle these matters. Now, also, Ed remarked when Lee was giving an introduction of Ed, and then I've had the same thoughts when you're introducing me. It's kind of like listening to, you know, your eulogy. And reminded me, I got a call about 2 weeks ago from Adam Clymer of the New York Times. And he called me out. He said, now, let me get this straight. He said, you're in your 70s and you've had a heart attack. I said, that's correct. He said, I'm writing your obituary. And so this is the truth. And for those of us in the newspaper business, he knew that I would understand that you do this in the newspaper business. You write these obits in advance for people that are at high risk of kicking off, so you'll be ready to go. So, but I thought that was kind of chilling to think someone is writing my obituary, much less somebody at the New York Times, and, you know, God forbid. But anyway, I'm still here, still above the grass, as I like to say, not under it, and wanted to reflect on the Weaver part of this as opposed to the digital part. The only digital I have is the digitalis that I take. So I could talk about that if you find that of interest. But anyway, I knew Professor Weaver. I'm of such an age that I knew him personally and admired him greatly. And so I, when it was proposed to me by Ken and Peter that I talk about him, I gratefully accepted the invitation. Now, a couple of things I want to say that I'm not sure how Richard Weaver would react to the world in which we live today. Some of the things that are going on. There are those who say that there's been a dumbing down of our popular culture. Not me, I don't say that, but that is said. That I responded that, I've used this line before, people do criticize our culture today, but it's kind of like Mark Twain's comment about Wagner's music. It's not as bad as it sounds. And if you take a look at some events occurring these days, you have to look for the subtext, the code, kind of a Straussian type approach to popular culture. And so let me just take an example. We had a very fine and informative session this morning about Greek philosophy, Plato, Aristotle, and so on. It reminded me a little bit recently of the comment by the Reverend Al Sharpton, who I think it was the rally that was held competitive with Glenn Beck's rally, in which he said, and I think I've got this right, we don't need to learn anything from Socrates and them Greek homos. Now, that sounds very negative. And yet, you have to interpret it. And what I think he was saying in his way was very Weaverian. I think what he was saying is that, indeed, there is a paradigm of essences that to which the phenomenology of the world is in continuing approximation, but not strictly along the Athenian model. Okay, so there's that. On Reverend Al's behalf, I thank you. The next item, many people have criticized, she was mentioned last night, Lady Gaga. I'm not sure some of the more mature folk here even know who Lady Gaga is. But she is quite a prominent personage these days. And some people think she's frivolous and silly and so on. But I would call to your attention that about 2 weeks ago at the MTV Music Video Awards. And by the way, MTV doesn't run music videos anymore, so I don't know why they do this, but we need to have a Philly sock about that and what's going on there. But anyway, Lady Gaga won a whole slew of awards. And on one of these occasions, she kept changing her outfits, and on one of these occasions, she showed up in a dress made entirely of meat. Now, there are those who say that Lady Gaga did this just to attract attention. But she's wearing a dress made entirely of meat. Think about this. And so, this is some kind of statement. It's some kind of, she's making a point here. And what is the point? And I think the point is perhaps the following. That the created order and all therein are placed under our dominion, albeit subject to the higher law of the Creator. I mean, isn't that what she's saying? Perhaps not. Why otherwise is she wearing a dress made of meat? I put it to you. So then we had the reference, marvelous reference today about the legislating the value of pi. And you may recall in that discussion, it was a question of whether it was the Alabama legislature or the Indiana legislature. I worked for many years covering the Indiana legislature, and I now spend a lot of time in Alabama, so I'm good either way with this. But it is a fact that this effort to legislate the value of pi was in fact done by the Indiana legislature, I'm proud to say. And it reminded me, just in passing, because Richard Weaver was from North Carolina, and one of the episodes of the Andy Griffith Show, and I'm sorry to see he's gone bad recently, was Opie comes back from school, and Andy says, "What did you learn in school today, Ope?" And he said, "Pa, we learned pi r squared." And Andy says, "That's wrong, Ope. Pi r round." Cornbread r squared. But that's kind of a digression. I want to get back to my main point, which is the Indiana legislature, which I covered for 16 years. And I've told this story, I think some of the Journalism Center people have heard this, but I don't think I've told it here at Philly Sock. But a member of the Indiana legislature got elected on an insurgent slate in 1972, running against the machine, conservative Republican, from Beech Grove, which is south of Indianapolis. And he was like a tool and die maker and so forth, a good guy. But he really was not very well versed in issues, and he was so naive as to think that I was, which of course I wasn't. But he would call up almost every night about something was going to happen in the legislature, and my wife would say, it's like Vernon Wormer, I'll call him that. It's Vernon Wormer for you. And he always said, well, they're bringing this thing up, and the bill will come up tomorrow. What do you think? So I tried to tell him what I thought. And so one night he called up. It's Vernon Wormer. He said, Stan, have you ever heard of something called the National Endowment for the Human Itties? Human itties. Humanities? Yeah, whatever. I said, yeah, I've heard of it. He said, they're trying to bring it down to Indiana University and the other universities. There's humanities. He said, I don't like the sound of it. I said, I don't either. I said to him, federal money, we don't need it. Get it out of here. Okay, I said, well, I'm going to find out about you. It's Thursday. You got a budget here. So I said, okay, Vernon, good luck. I said, remember, humanities. So I forget this. And then Sunday, they had a section in the Indianapolis Star, which was the news and sister paper. And they had a section called Behind Closed Doors, which is like gossip or, you know, behind the scenes at the legislature. And Sunday morning, sitting there at the breakfast table, I open it up and I see this headline that says, in quotes, phonetically spelled out, what's this here human itties? And I'm reading this, and just unbelievable. The lead was, the presidents of all four state universities were stunned Thursday morning by an onslaught from state Representative Vernon Wormer, demanding to know, what's this here human itties? And I thought to myself, I'm sitting here just thinking of this scene of the president of all four state universities, the budget committee, this guy's sitting on that committee, he holds the power of life and death over their budget. And they're trembling beneath the steely gaze of State Representative Vernon Wormer. And I thought to myself, yes, this is America, man. Get used to it. And so that's Indiana legislature, which is my segue to Professor Weaver, believe it or not. Professor Weaver was a great admirer of Indiana, I think partially because of scenes like that. And he once described Indiana as the most American state. And there's some room for argument there, but when I was in the state, I accepted that accolade and on behalf of my colleagues and fellow citizens. I had been an admirer of Richard Weaver from 1958 when I chanced across a copy of Ideas Have Consequences. I was then a 24-year-old punk cub reporter at Human Events in Washington. I read this book. I was flabbergasted at the profundity of it, the way it was written, the points it made. I was then making a princely $8,000 a year. This book was not yet in paperback. I bought 10 hardcover copies of it from the University of Chicago Press and mailed them to 10 people saying, you must read this book. And so I was a fan of his from that day forward. The next year, I'm out in Indiana now. Don Lipsett of sainted memory, a good friend of ours, Ed's, mine, Ken's, many others, he was the impresario, the Saul Hurock of conservative meetings. He never stopped organizing meetings. He loved to do it, and he did it well. And he wanted to have a seminar at Brown County State Park in down near Nashville, Indiana, on the subject, and we talked about it, conservative or libertarian, which are we? This is 1959. And he organized the meeting, and he asked me to get the speakers. We had three speakers. We had Milton Friedman to represent the libertarian side. We had Frank Meyer to represent the so-called fusionist side, although I don't like that term. And we had Richard Weaver to represent the traditionalist side. That's not a bad trifecta. Milton Friedman, Frank Meyer, Richard Weaver. And I had the honor of contacting Professor Weaver and also the honor of looking after him while he was there, because he would wander off, and he was really a down-home guy. And I couldn't find him. It was, where's Professor Weaver? Go find him. And so I did find him. He was at, I heard music coming out of one of the, it's a place where they have lots of different events. And it was fiddle music and bluegrass and country, and he was in there enjoying that music. So I had to get him and bring him out. That's the kind of person he was. By the way, should say that that meeting was financed by Pierre Goodrich. It was sort of a precursor to the Liberty Fund colloquium. I'm pretty sure Al Campbell was there, board member of ISI, and it was really an offshoot of ISI. Someone referred today, I forget who, to the essay Conservative or Libertarian, Which Are We? By Richard Weaver. That was a talk he gave in Brown County. Mm-hmm. Is it in Visions of Order? Or?
Yes, and we published it as a pamphlet.
Okay, that was the talk he gave. So that was my first personal contact with Professor Weaver. 1 year later, 50 years ago this fall, we had an ISI board meeting in Indianapolis at the Indianapolis Athletic Club. And Lee has pictures from this event in his book about ISI. And at that event, Professor Weaver, we had kind of a seminar in connection with it. And again, Al Campbell was there and so forth. And Professor Weaver gave a presentation. And I asked him, where's Bill? Bill, where are you at? Bill Campbell. Do you have the tape of this?
Yes.
You've got the tape. Okay, so I got to be careful what I say. I can't fake it. I asked, and correct me if I'm wrong, it should be on the tape. He gave the usual fine presentation. I said to him, Professor Weaver, what is it we need to do to redeem the time, or something like that? And he, without hesitation, he said, we need unshakable books. Am I right? That was in the fall of 1960. And I never forgot that. And when looking back at what happened thereafter, and of course there's all this interconnection between ISI, the Liberty Fund idea, later the Philadelphia Society, but this was all before any of that. But you look back at that era, and I said this at the National Review 50th banquet 5 years ago, we were blessed. We didn't know it at the time. With the people, we had giants among us. We had Richard Weaver. We had Russell Kirk. We had Frank Meyer. We had Milton Friedman. We had von Mises. We had Hayek. And the list is long. They wrote the unshakable books on which the conservative movement was built. Now, there was a lot of building to be done based on that foundation, and that's another story. But that was the foundation, those books by those people. Now, we're in a different era, and we are being told by some, but George Gilder eloquently answered this at noon, so I don't need to dwell on it, but we've been told by some books are basically obsolete. No more, we don't need books now. We have all this other stuff. We have all the electronic gizmos and the internet and blogging and tweeting and Twittering and Facebooking and all those other good things. And books are obsolete. Well, I'm of an age, George, you may remember this, back 68, there was a man named Marshall McLuhan. Remember him? And he wrote a book called The Medium is the Message. And he was on many TV shows saying, in essence, kind of what's being said now. I think you referred to this elusively in your talk at noon. Very fine talk it was. And I reflected at the time. This guy is saying books and print are obsolete. But what did he do to make this case. He wrote a book. Take a look at the internet. What is the biggest success story on the internet? Probably Amazon.com. They sell books. The very fine presentation by the gentleman about the cyber dissidents. Are you here among us, sir? That was a marvelous presentation. And I thought when you were talking about the difference between the way the Russian Soviet dissidents were treated and what's happening now in the Middle East, maybe one of the differences was the Gulag Archipelago. That got everybody's attention. There is an unshakable book. Came out in 1974. And it was after that that people started paying attention to what was going on in the Soviet Union. And the story goes on and on and on. So I won't dwell on it. I will say that George summed it up for me. Whatever the delivery platform, whether it's an iPod or an IHOP, I go there sometimes, or whatever, you've got to have more than a cascading streams of data. Somebody has to put the data into some kind of coherent form. Usually it has to be a long form. It has to be in some kind of context. And so therefore, whatever the delivery mechanism, it's the same thing. And I still teach journalism. And now we're not journalists anymore. We are content providers. And now we have doctors, we have health care providers. And I guess when Obama gets the death panel set up, like I said, hi, I'll be your death provider. But anyway, we're providers, but so there has to be content. And so it's the same deal, whatever the form. And I would say beyond that, that data aren't information. Information isn't knowledge, and knowledge isn't wisdom. And maybe au contraire to the Greeks, as Al Sharpton would point out, I think, wisdom is not necessarily virtue, which is a distinction that sometimes gets lost. We have, however, experienced, and this is unavoidable, what I would call the death of reading. Not that we don't need the books, but that people are getting out of the habit of reading them, as they've gotten out of the habit of reading the legislation in Washington. I thought Nancy Pelosi was very on point when she said, we need to pass the health care bill to know what is in it. And we're finding out that she's right. We had Eric Holder, who is the attorney, if he is a real person, I'm not sure that he is, who said that he was condemning the Arizona immigration law, but when asked, he had not read it. He's also, if that is a real person, said under interrogation from a couple of members of Congress from Texas, back up a little bit, that when, remember the Pakistani car bomber who drove his car into the middle of Times Square, and they by luck, some vendors tipped the cops off and they got him. The next day I heard that first it was Mayor Bloomberg. And is he real? Anybody here from New York? I mean, these people have got to be characters out of Tom Wolfe. These cannot be actual human beings. And Mayor Bloomberg said, and I heard him say this, he said, well, what do you think? This guy's a Pakistani. He drives a car loaded with bombs into Times Square. And so Mayor Bloomberg is asked, what is motivating this guy? And Bloomberg says, probably somebody's upset about the health care bill. He actually said that. I mean, and then Holder was questioned about the same thing and by the congressman and said, what do you think is motivating all these terrorist acts? He said, well, there are many factors that enter in, factors of, you don't know. You never know what could be motivating these people. One, I think it was Lamar Smith said, could one of them be radical Islam? Holder said, "What? Radic? You can't say it. Radic." So I have a saying from all of this, and I won't try to go into why this is happening, which is a paraphrase of the great Ronald Reagan. You and I have a rendezvous with density. And it is occurring right now. There's one other aspect to the death of reading, which involves myself, even though I'm still here, and that is sort of a philosophical conundrum. Is it possible, if you go to e-books, which is kind of what George is talking about, e-books are all this, electronic stuff, would it be possible for an author to write a book which he cannot himself read? And in my case, the answer would be yes, it is possible. All right, so to wrap this up a little bit, we need books, however they're defined, however the content is delivered. They need to be placed in some kind of larger, the data need to be some larger structure, they need to be long form, they need to be coherent. But, and here's the other part of the Weaver axiom, they must be unshakable books, not just books. You know, there are all kinds of books. This is all kind of stuff on the internet. And therefore, the books must be vetted by people who know how to do it for truth, which is based on history, solid scholarship, much reflection, and stand the test of time, which is true of all the authors I named before. Now, I'm trying to emulate Professor Weaver, became a writer of books. I don't know how shakable they are, but I've written books, a fair amount of them. And the book, The Theme is Freedom, to which Ken refers, published by our pal Al Regnery in 1994. And Al had a reception at Sidney Kramer Bookstore in Washington, D.C., for all of his many authors at that time. And I was invited there, so I go there, and people are milling around, having hors d'oeuvres and whatnot. And I'm conversing with a couple. I did not know who they were. They obviously didn't know who I was. And I said, "Look, well, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I didn't want to preen myself, but I was, you know, author and like that." And so I was going to say, "I wrote a book." But that sounded like distant past. So I thought, well, I'll change it to, "I have written a book." And I, being a wordsmith, I'm balancing these two expressions at lightning speed in my mind when a very attractive young lady came up and distracted me. And those who know me know that I'm easily distracted that way. And totally, "Hi, Stan," and threw me off. And what I wound up saying was, "I have wrote a book." And so the I can see this couple looking at me. Why do you explain something like that? I can see the guy driving home. They're going home. It's like, "Well, we need to be running along, Gladys." And so he's driving. They're driving home, and he's saying to his wife, "What kind of publishing company is Al Regnery running? He had a guy there who's a complete moron." And so, but that's what I just say. And so I just want to say to all the Weaver fellows, past and present, those here tonight and those not with us, that I want to salute you, them, and all of the unshakable books that you have wrote. And that we will write in the future. My time is up. I thank you for yours.